Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, and welcome to Everything is Fine, a podcast for women over 40. We are your hosts. I'm Kim France.
And I'm Jen Romolini.
How are you feeling today, Jen?
I'm feeling good. I'm enjoying the new Kim France Substack, I'll tell you that.
Thank you. Thank you very much for enjoying my Substack. It's been so nice to have like a new little toy.
It's fun to get an email from you every day. I really like it. I really like it. It's just a surprise every time. And it's just, I'm liking seeing you in a different format. And it feels like you're writing more somehow.
I am writing more, you know, not every day, but I am trying to write more because the goal is to eventually add paid stuff that would be more like less shopping, more writing.
If anybody doesn't know, if anybody missed the episodes where Kim's blog just tanked and Kim was forced to switch over to Substack, but forced is, it actually wound up being a very good thing to be forced.
Well, it's something that I wanted to do.
Yeah.
It's something that I had been thinking about. It's something that I had been talking to someone at Substack about, and I was never going to do it unless this happened. Yeah. I would just have kept doing the blog forever. And so I'm very excited about it. It's kind of fun. And there's like a community of like-minded people. And
yeah,
it's just good.
I'm really glad that you're over on Substack. Everybody go follow Kim on Substack. It's going to be great.
Yeah, go follow me. It's going to be fun. And I'm probably going to end up publishing some chapters from the book I decided not to publish there. And so just, it'd be, you know, if you're interested at all, it's worth checking out.
Everybody should be interested in Kim France writing, in my opinion. but speaking of your Substack and your tips, you gave the greatest fucking tip of all time a couple of weeks ago, which was the, is it Great Jones, the foundation?
Oh, Jones Road.
Jones Road. Okay. The Jones Road, what the foundation? I ordered it. It's incredible.
It's crazy.
And I got it, right? And usually I just slop everything on my face, like finger paint with my hands, but I also got a brush. Mm-hmm. I've been enjoying makeup more than I have ever enjoyed makeup. I ordered from Jones Road. I ordered the What the Foundation. I ordered that pencil, that concealer pencil. And I ordered the mascara, which I think is the best mascara on the market right now. I really do think it's the best one.
Yeah, I like that mascara.
So anyway, I ordered those things with some brushes and I've been like my skin, I've been able to cover like my dark circle, like everything.
It's just sort of like, it's kind of like it's magic.
Yes.
Like how does it know to kind of make me look a little tan?
Yes.
And it's so sheer, but somehow it really like covers up what it needs to cover up.
Yes. But it doesn't feel like, I mean, really they should be giving us money for this, but because this is not an ad, everyone, yeah. But it should be because it doesn't have like a real thickness. It's not thick going on, but it's also coverage.
No, and it looks like it's going to be thick going on because it comes in this tub that looks like Nivea.
Yes.
You know, the consistency of like Nivea. And you're like, ugh, I'm going to put that on my face. But it goes on so light.
It goes on so nice and smells nice. Like I'm just a convert. Like I have been an Ilia foundation person for, I don't know, the past 5 years. And I am now completely converted to, and also have been wearing more makeup and really like being like, oh, this is just like a fun ritual now that I do.
It is. Well, you know, women's serotonin level gets higher when they put on makeup.
Oh, really?
When women are grooming themselves, their serotonin, not every woman, obviously.
Right, right, right.
But like, yeah, it's a phenomenon.
I've also been, another thing I've been doing is every night I've been using that French retinol cream just on my neck, the A313. And I have to say, like, my neck skin is getting pretty intensely crepey. And, like, I just am, like, trying to practice radical acceptance and whatever. Fuck, 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 whatever. Everybody hates when I talk about my neck, but here it is. But I will say, on my neck, for some reason, versus my face, which it was, like, irritating, on my neck can handle it. And it's actually, like, making my skin on my neck not be as – it's helping this, the crepiness of the skin on my neck.
Really? Because I have – my skin is too sensitive for retinol. I can't – nobody has said I should use it. But my neck, I bet, could handle it.
Yes. And the A313 cream is, it's, you know, it's like the whatever, the like makeup artist secret or whatever. And it's like $30. It's not that expensive. And it lasts for a really long time. And it's like putting Vaseline on your neck. It's like not, you know, it's, that's what it feels, that's the texture of it. But I've been doing it every night for a week and I've already noticed like a little bit of a change. Like it feels like more supple and it just, it doesn't look like a scrotum.
Well, then that's success. That's victory.
I feel really bad having this conversation at the beginning of this because our guest today is like such like a lovely woman. Like I feel like I'm having this like filthy animal conversation at the beginning.
I know.
And like,
no, we've got such a good episode today, and it's true. We're being as superficial and lame as she was deep and meaningful.
Yeah, like Jamia Wilson like elevated the show. Like she's such an amazing. I've all just admired her work for so long. She's an amazing activist, feminist, writer, smart as hell. I just really like her a lot. Before we get into it, what's going on with you this week? Anything new?
Well, my stepson is moving in with us for the summer.
How are you feeling about that?
I'm excited about it.
Okay.
I mean, it's definitely, you know, I mean, having three people in this place as opposed to two is going to cramp our style in some ways.
One bathroom, right?
One bathroom. That's really the only thing I worry about is the one bathroom. But I'm excited. I mean, I love him. He got an internship here for the summer and, you know, Paul's going to be gone some of the summer on tour. I'm not going for all of tour. And so it'll be great to have him around for that.
It's going to be a lot. It's going to be a lot.
Yeah, talk to me in 2 weeks. I don't know.
Exactly. 3 weeks. Just because I live with a teenager. I mean, a young, much younger teenager, but you know, it's wait, is he a teenager still?
He is 20. I believe he is not yet 21.
Okay. All right. So not quite a teenager. So a little like an adult.
An adult who always wanted to hang out with the adults.
Mm.
So he's not as mortified by like being in the presence of adults.
Oh, well, that's nice. That's nice. I mean, maybe you'll have dinner parties. Maybe it'll be a delight.
I think it will be a delight. I'm really looking forward to it. I, you know, it'll be, it's like a novelty for me.
Yeah. Don't let my shitty attitude about children rain on this parade. I just am used to somebody being like, oh God, stop, shut up. You're saying the bad.
Oh my God. Should we get into this episode already?
Yeah, let's get into it. Our guest today is Jamia Wilson. Jamia is an award-winning feminist activist, writer, and currently a vice president and executive editor at Random House. As the former director of the Feminist Press at the City University of New York and former VP of programs at the Women's Media Center, Jamia has been a leading voice on women's rights issues for more than a decade. Her works appeared in numerous outlets, including the New York Times, the Today Show, CNN, BBC, Rookie, and the Washington Post. She is also the author of numerous books, including This Book is Feminist, Young, Gifted, and Black, Step Into Your Power, 23 Lessons on How to Live Your Best Life, Big Ideas for Young Thinkers, The ABCs of AOC, I can't believe all these books, and the co-author of Roadmap for Revolutionaries, Resistance, Advocacy, and Activism for All. Jamia's latest book, Young, Gifted, and Black 2, was released in April. Welcome, Jamia. Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so excited to have you. And, you know, I've long admired you and your work, and you've done so much in your life, and you've had such an inspiring career. It's almost hard to know where to begin, but it feels like most of your adult life has focused on activism of some kind. Can you tell us how you knew you wanted to get into this kind of work?
Thank you so much for your kind introduction. I think a lot of it is coming from just how I was raised. I was raised by family that was really active in the civil rights movement. My parents were a little bit older than a lot of my other friends, just by a little bit, having grown up in Jim Crow, having experienced the civil rights movement directly and having had their parents being actively involved, especially on my mom's side. And because of that, I was just taught that if you don't like the conditions that you're seeing in the world, for yourself or for others, that it's your job to remake the world. And you do that by taking action. You do that by organizing. You do that by speaking up.
And that almost could feel radical in these times when it's so, with these moments, like since 2016, when we have just felt so demoralized in so many ways, right? The idea that being proactive is the best way to be instead of like falling into a hole of negativity. How can you talk about that a little bit? How do you do that?
I think a lot of it has to do with my spiritual beliefs. I was at a wedding over the weekend, and it was a Jewish wedding, and it was for agnostic friends who are Jewish, who are interested in exploring their cultural connection to what their ancestors had done for many years. And I was talking about at that wedding that it's often a curiosity for people who understand the radical way that I grew up, my activism, that I am a religious person, yeah, that I'm a deeply spiritual person. And so big part of how I learned activism was from being a part of the faith community. My mom saw Martin Luther King speak at church when she was a child. I was raised in a church that was very much about this being a part of the work, being a part of the motivation for why you take action. And so I would be remiss if I didn't share, which is what is sometimes controversial in a lot of the spaces I'm in when people see me as a left person and a progressive person, that I'm a Christian. And that's been a big part of it. A Christian who actually follows what Christ said we should do, when we're living in community with others. And I want to put a caveat on that. And so that is a big part of the motivation for me, to be honest, is about my own quest in this life to be closer to spirit. And the way that I see it as a Christian mystic is to be close to the highest love, you have to act out of love. You have to act in a way to spread love, to spread light. You have to be an acolyte. And for me, that's why it's always deeply personal to me. That has been a guiding light. It's mostly about devotion.
That's so inspiring. And at the same time, how do you hold on to the light and not get angry and not feel frustrated? Or you do, I guess.
I'm angry all the time. And I'm angry a lot of the time about what people do in the name of the religion that I follow. But people do, as I sort of like to joke tongue in cheek, as false prophets of this in terms of the radical evangelical right, yeah, and their faux Christianity. For me, one of my authors, Megan Watterson, whose book I'm editing, The Girl Who Baptized Herself, is a feminist theologian. And she talks about how Christ himself would not have called himself a Christian.
Interesting.
And I think about that a great deal in terms of what guides me in my work. And I have charged myself with speaking more publicly about it because I didn't for a really long time because I thought, oh, sometimes this foments distrust by people who've been hurt by the church.
Yeah.
And I understand that and they've been hurt by the institution. But I sort of try to lead myself to follow those teachings of what does it really mean to want to make a world where love is supreme, and however you get there, whatever that path is. I also think in terms of the allegory, because I am quite religious, is about, you know, even in my faith, the following of Christ is to know that Christ got angry in the face of injustice. He flipped the tables. And so I think about that often when I need to flip the tables. And one of the things that has been very healing to me is to look at spiritual archetypes of fierce women, not only in my holy book, but in others, like the divine, feminine, sacred, angry, alchemical, transformative energy as something that really inspires me, because I think that a lot of times anger is actually a deep, close partner to love. It's a despair over a failure to love, a failure to be in community, a failure to listen deeply, a failure to understand that each of us is deeply connected. And so when you injure another, you injure yourself. All of that is sort of a part of what I think about and what leads my work. But I also feel like anger for women is important. We have been taught by so many different institutional conditionings, and I've also experienced this in a bad way from churches I've been a part of, that you know, it is not, you cannot be a good girl if you are angry. You cannot be a good girl if you are too much, you're too loud, you're taking up too much space. And the people who've made the kinds of changes I like to see in the world that have reverberated for generations tend to be those kinds of people. And those are the ones I'm seeking to emulate. So I think that the anger is actually very productive. It's formative. And I have been really happy about writing from Brittany Cooper, from Soraya Shamali, from Rebecca Traister about why that anger is important to generate. But it needs to, it's important to generate, and it's important to understand and channel.
And not allow it to become corrosive.
Yes.
Yeah. But I guess that the love antidote is sort of like, if you're also coming from a place of love, the anger doesn't take you over. If you're seeing that in, because one of the things that you've talked about a lot is that, that we need to learn to get comfortable with people who don't agree with us.
Yes.
Can you talk about that? Because you just brought up listening. I think that I've heard you talk about deep listening. And I think that it is something that we're kind of missing right now in the world, is listening to each other rather than talking over each other.
Yes. So, you know, I love that. One of the things I really love is thinking about how we learned what leadership looks like, and who's a leader, and how they lead, and how we're supposed to lead. And so much of what we have been taught about who a leader is, what they should look like, what they should sound like, is actually toxic. It's actually about dehumanizing and making others subordinate, dominating, being right above all else, being the one who is more heard than somebody else. And that has just never set right with me. It's just never set right in my soul. And so what has felt true is sort of the deep listening of nature, the ability to get still enough in a meditation, or, you know, I like to imagine oneself as a tree, sort of as my meditation, that I can actually take in and understand everything happening around me, knowing that, okay, the thing that is constant for me is I'm that tree, but what's happening around me is the weather, and how do I interpret it from a place of neutrality so that I can come forward with it with a response and not a reaction that is coming from some ego place, but something that's coming from a love place. So I'm not always doing that 100% in alignment or in healthy ways. Let's just say I'm a human like everybody else, but it's something I strive toward. And I think that the striving has been really helpful to help me become a better listener, but also to take responsibility when I'm not.
Yeah.
And I think that's important.
You've also said most humans share the same core values, and we just have conflicts about how to get there. Do you still believe this? Do you okay. Tell me, walk me through it, because, you know, it can really, like, all the trans stuff that's happened, like everything, the abortion, like, help me.
So I think what's really hard is there are a lot of people who we feel are the majority because they are the loudest, because they are the most visible with their hatred, with their bigotry, with their attempts to dominate and subvert progress with their backlash. And I think that the majority of good folks whose voices we might not hear as much because they might not be the ones that are getting the megaphone or being amplified, majority of good folks, when they have access to the proper information, to truth, to hear many sides of things, to nuance, tend to, I think, at heart, want to do right by themselves and by other people, tend to want to come from a place of love. I think it's actually more core to our being as humans than what we have experienced in capitalism and late stage capitalism. There's all this amazing work by Rhian Eisler about the history of humanity and partnership and how in the earliest indigenous communities and the earliest people, partnership, collaboration, community, connection, those were the things that were more important. And then when we came into capitalism, the shift changed and the values changed. So when I think about what is core to being most essential as a human, it's actually immaterial. The problem is that we've been conditioned to believe that it's all material, that you have to buy a right to be healthy. You have to buy a right to be loved. You have to buy a right to be in community. You have to buy a right to accessing the most basic things. But I actually don't think that's connected to the fundamental experience of being human. Those are all toxic things that have been created by humans, right. But they are not intrinsic to us. And so a big part of what I hope to do, which is why I do the children's book writing that I do, is to foster empathy and social emotional learning among the youngest to say, even though we're being fed this narrative, you don't have to believe it. You don't have to believe that you're inherently in competition with your classmates. You don't have to believe that we're living in a Hobbesian world of dog eat dog. Right. You can choose another way.
I also think when it comes to finding common ground with your enemies, you know, that you can't see the humanity in people necessarily if you can't just see them being humans. You know, if you can't just see the way that they get their kid ready for school in the morning or what kind of coworker they are, you just see them as, you know, this sort of faceless enemy out to do bad things. And I say this just because I've recently had a chance to be around people whose politics are really different from me. And the thing that makes everyone able to get along is we're not engaging about that. And I know that's not the point. I know we have to engage. But just to first see with the humanity in the other people seems really key.
I love that. I mean, that's the thing. And I struggle with it myself. That's what I was going to say. I mean, you know, those who know me closely, my husband, you know, my family, I am someone who, although I would say I consider myself to be a very loving and thoughtful person, I actually am a very fire-spirited person. You know, anyone messes with my family or anyone, I am quick to anger. But I'm quick to love too. And one of the things I try to do to bring myself back to like what is true, what is real, is to seek the humanity in others, even if that is not what I'm receiving myself. And it doesn't mean to not have them be accountable. I think for myself, it is actually a good practice to understand what it is I'm responding to. You know, sometimes I'm thinking about mansplaining just because it's the thing that comes to mind, but like mansplaining and being edged out by like toxic masculine dynamics in a conversation or whatever, and thinking about, oh, like what part of that dude's inner child is feeling unseen and feeling like he's got to step all over mine to be seen? And how would I deal with a petulant child right now who is trying to get my attention?
Wow.
With what kind of heart and voice would I approach that? And getting curious about it has, one, helped me just in terms of like how I want to show up, how I want to respond, but it also takes away sort of the power of being on the end of other people's externalizations of that. And I also think it's very separate from their humanity. I think that's a big part of it that I do really, truly believe. You know, I'm editing a book right now too with my colleague Mark Warren about Reverend James Lawson, who is just an amazing figure, an architect of the civil rights movement and the Memphis sanitation strike. And his almost century-long commitment, he's in his 90s, to nonviolent resistance. And nonviolence as an active form of resistance. And leading with love being a part of his teachings. And one of the reasons that I wanted to work on this book is because, although I consider myself a proponent of nonviolence, there is a part of me that very much knows that it is in my nature and in my spirit to do the other way.
Yeah.
If called into that. And I actually know that of my own response because I was mugged once and I fought back, which other people were saying you might have thought about doing something else there because that could have gone another bad way. But that's how I sort of, I said, oh, I learned a lot about my nature in that. But I think about it a great deal, this idea of what does it mean to lead with love? You know, to even have just that philosophy, it doesn't mean that you're held to always do it that way, but to have that be the predominant way of showing up that is active and it's not passive, that is true to the nature of our souls and who we should be. I think, you know, am I defined by the traumas that I've experienced? I don't think so. Am I defined by other people's externalizations of who I should be? No. And so I try not to inflict that on other people, but I also believe in righteous accountability. And I believe that it's important for us to hold each other accountable as well.
Well, no, you've said that we're all being called to be more brave. We're being called to create what we need in the world. What does that look like?
Thank you for that question. I think that it changes. It changes with time and the phases of our lives, the chapters of our lives. It changes every day. You know, you caught me on a day where I just wrote to that author, Megan Watterson, who I was talking with you about her book, The Girl Who Baptized Herself. And I wrote her today and I said, thank you for the gift of being able to edit this book, because now I ask myself every day, how can I baptize myself today? And that's my way of saying to myself, how can I claim my spiritual authority? How can I divorce myself from external notions of who I should be, how I should produce, how I should show up, how I should be productive in a world that values my labor only, not my being? And how can I give holy reverence to the body, spirit, embodied sovereignty of this woman self and this Black woman self in this world? And there's something about that that is very juicy. And so the part of me being more brave in my life right now is asking myself that question, because I was so raised in the church and in other spaces to be of service to others and not in service to my own needs. And I'm healing that now by expecting and fostering reciprocity in my relationships, but what I'm building, how I'm curating my life around me, the boundaries that I'm setting, all of those things. And that's how I'm being more brave. At another time in my life, being more brave was eating when I was hungry, not promoting toxic talk about the body that I had absorbed, about not looking like I had been told by 90s culture that I should look to matter, to be accepted, to be included in mostly all white affluent environments, because I went to a very elite private boarding school where I was one of 12 Black students.
Oh,
and so I think it changes in our lives. I think we're called to be more brave as bystanders when we see injustice for others, to speak. I think a lot about that, you know, to be the one to speak when everyone else is looking away. I ask myself a lot, what would have happened if someone on that train with Jordan Neely had come in and said stop and stopped it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's who we should be. That's how we be more brave.
Well, imagine the people who were sitting in that subway car who didn't say stop and wish they did and were too scared to.
Exactly, to interrupt that which insults who we are in the core of our spirit, not in the ego space, not in the external space, not in the monetary space, but who we actually are in our spirit as humans. And I think about it quite a great deal, because I feel like, I don't know anyone else here, I'm trying to use I statements, but in a lot of the friends I have, the thing about my own self, I identify with the scapegoat women across history, like in a familial sense, in a community sense. I am scapegoat material, okay? And was always that way. And friend stuff, all that. And
yes,
it was because I was, you know, the sort of the messy one who would say, that's not fair. I don't like how you're talking to her. And that's not cool. And the truth.
Well, we wouldn't know about that.
You're on the scapegoat podcast.
Right. I was going to say, I have a feeling that I'm in sisterhood. Yes. And those are my favorite people. I'm like, I want to hang out with the people who, like, they would have burnt right up on the stake next to me. You know what I mean? And another time, you know, we would have been like lit up. But I think about that all the time. And I always have to have the dark gallows humor about it. But I think that those are the people that I want to roll with, because I know that the people who are my people know that I am going to ride for them. Yeah. And that's what I really value about being more brave. But I also think being more brave in terms of being able to have a vision for something and not be able to see it immaterial yet. And maybe it's connected with faith again. Yeah. And when I mean faith, I don't mean a faith like a God faith, but I mean faith that, hey, I can have a prophetic vision just because this is what I'm being told that work needs to look like, or community or friendship or relationships or partnerships need to look like, just because that's what I've been seeing or what I've been told or how it's always been, that maybe we can reimagine it, make something new altogether, remix it, reauthor the story of power, reauthor how we engage with each other. And that's being more brave, to be brave enough to say, hey, yeah, I know we've always done it this way, but I have a vision for another way.
Yeah.
That's being more brave.
Can we talk really quickly about, I'm wondering what you would say to or ask about a person who was looking to build a spiritual practice, who wanted that in their life and felt like it wasn't there?
So, one, I love this question. I would say what I would want for that person is to think about, what are the conditions and the experiences you've had where you felt the most free? Write those down. And what were the elements that were present that made you feel the most free? And write down and explore what that brought up for you, what kinds of insights it brought up for you, what kinds of feelings it did, how those feelings might have engaged with you in a way that affected how you treated other people. Because in my eyes, that is an engagement with spirit, and the engagement of our spirit with the spirits that dwells within others. But I also feel that reading a lot about other people's spirituality and spiritual experiences can help a great deal. I feel that my devotion, which is a word I really love, because I'm devoted to my activism too, that my devotion comes from reading about other people's devotion. I love reading about what it means to surrender to something higher than yourself. So for some people, that might be called God. For some, that might be spirit. For some people, that might be a small g. For some people, that might be a big G. For some people, that might be an asterisk instead of an O. but whatever that is, maybe it's, I've heard Michelle and Gio Cello in a concert recently, which was just like, amazing. In that concert, she stopped while singing a song. She was in the zone. The whole thing was perfection, masterful. But she stopped and she said, I needed to take a moment to center myself in my God. That just annihilated me, because I thought, that is what it is, that she needed a moment to reconnect that spark, that soul feeling. And I think for a lot of us, that we all possess it. And for some, it might not be connected to a soul sense or, you know, a institutional sense or anything, but that higher voice, that higher whisper, that higher sense of the thing that makes you, you, the highest love is how, you know, Megan Watterson talks about it in her books, whatever that is, to try to create the conditions that gets you to a place of being able to hear them. I think a lot of when we see people being misaligned from that sense, or feeling confused or feeling separate from a spiritual feeling when they want to connect with it and when they want to conjure, it comes from there being too much noise, from trauma, from externalized oppression, from just the noise of life, the demands of others. And so I think for many, it could be about sitting out in nature, getting into that. It could be about dance. I find a connection to spirit when I dance. I also would say this is a very tactical one, but for me, one of the biggest and most strongest spiritual gifts that I have received has been walking labyrinths. And if I can find labyrinths wherever I go traveling, that is a place where I get all the downloads and have all the transcendent experiences. And there's a history of labyrinth walking, and also a feminist history of it, if you've heard the story of Ariadne and all of that and her red thread. But I feel that, you know, the sense of walking the path to seek the answer, or to, which is really seeking a closer connection with yourself, is such a great way to start, to do a walking meditation, to just see what the maze tells you about yourself and about life. And it's not always transactional. It's not always, oh, well, I tried to have this moment and I tried to meditate really intensely and I didn't get anything. You know, I've heard people have that kind of experience. And I want to say, no, it's more of sometimes the lesson is showing up and 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 showing up, and showing up mm-hmm. until it comes. And that is actually the connection to spirit. So I think it's different for each of us. I also think connecting with the natural elements is also an important way that really has helped me. Water, ether, fire, air, connecting with elements and sitting with them and thinking about how do these elements relate to my higher sense of self and meaning in the world. I have a close connection to fire and also water, and being near and in connection with both has given me a lot of insight into who I am and sort of what motivates me and also what imbalances me.
Let's take a quick break from some ads.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
And we're back.
I want to loop back just for a minute. As a white woman who feels largely clueless a lot of the time, I want to talk about allyship, which you've written a lot about. How do you talk to women about being better allies and having their actions match their intentions?
It's a good question. I think continuing to show up, especially when it gets hard. So what I see happen sometimes is that really well-meaning people who want to show up and then they have an awkward moment or something falls apart or they get called out or they say a misstep, and the shame and the fear and the anger of not being perfect, which perfectionism comes from being reinforced in white supremacy and patriarchy and all these things I don't have to tell you, being a good girl in a Christian sense, right? All of that. I say, just keep showing up. It's again this idea that we have in late stage capitalism been made to feel like we have to have instant gratification for everything. And it's actually understandable. We can forgive ourselves for being conditioned to feel this way because, you know, everything from dating to food to healthcare and everything has been made possible online, and there are AIs who can do everything and all of that. And I have to remind myself, oh, I'm actually going to forgive myself for just being human and having absorbed all these things or being a part of it. And that actually my shame has no productive quality to it. What else can I tap into? Like, I'm curious about the shame, but like, what else can I tap into that can actually heal this, that can actually bring me together with others and connect? So the keep showing up, even when it gets hard, even if you make a mistake, the thing that I really, really don't like is having people say, well, I didn't say anything because I didn't know what to say, or I said the wrong thing last time, so now I've just given up and I'm taking my toys and I'm going home. And I ask, can you be humble enough to say, I'm so sorry, I missed the mark this time, thank you for your grace. I'll do better next time. What can I do more to step up? I'll do more listening. How can I help repair? That's the kind of restorative engagement I want us to have. And that is what I'm asking of allies, is to keep showing up. Do it better next time. It's not about winning the allyship contest. It's about doing the work together in community.
And not being afraid to, like, to be, you said it, like, to be embarrassed, to be humiliated, to be full of shame. You know, that's just that's the price of doing business.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
There was, this is a totally terrible example, but if anybody saw the Real World reunion, I don't know if anybody saw the, okay.
Oh, I know Kevin Powell. He's a friend. So I was like texting him being like, oh my gosh.
Becky had to do was hold space. And she instead, she just took her ball and went home. She just couldn't, she couldn't handle the shame, and she couldn't handle, if anybody doesn't know what we're talking about, it's like, so the original Real World, which had Kevin and Julie and Eric Nies and
Jacinda.
No, she was on another one, but it doesn't matter. If anybody remembers the initial Real World, they had a reunion, and Kevin Powell in this reunion was addressing some of the racism that happened in the original show, which is like, what, 20, 30 years ago at this point? I think it's 30 years ago. Okay. And Becky, who was like the one who looked like, she was like an indie rock girl. She looked like every indie rock girl at that time. She was called out, and she just got, it was just watching like a white woman spiral, exactly how you don't want a white woman to spiral in this. You just watch the whole thing. She felt ashamed. It didn't fit her image of herself. She got super defensive. She fought it. She doubled down. He was like just saying, hey, now you're hurting my feelings. Like,
yeah.
And it was like, all she had to do was say, oh, I'm sorry. And take a beat. I don't know, Jimmy, if I'm right, but like, I watched that so closely and I was like, it's like, they should teach this in class.
A lot of times too, when people take responsibility for it, I appreciate it. I had someone recently call me the name of another Black woman that I know they know.
Oh no.
And I could tell that they were really mortified, and then they left the room, but then came back and apologized. And I just said, thank you. Thank you. Like, you know, I understand what's happening right now, but let's move past this. But I appreciate that you took the time to come to say, I'm sorry that happened, because the alternate part of that is what makes things harder to repair. And it also shows me that you see me as a person, which is what I didn't feel when you said that I was this other person, which is something that's commonly felt among POC. In the case of what happened on the Real World, it's amazing, because that same thing that happened with Becky also happened on the New Orleans reunion, and Julie did the exact same thing. She also just couldn't take responsibility. And the thing that really made me sad about how she was acting was I thought, oh, this is all your shame. Your shame and your need to save face and your need to silence other people, even if that is not your intention, to feel like you're good, is a thing that I hope you heal, because it's holding you back from real connections and relationships, and you're frustrated at these people for not wanting to connect with you. But actually making this effort would go a long way with these people who want to build with you, but they can't, because you have injured their ability to trust you with their vulnerability and their love. And I think that it was so interesting to sort of see her double down online, try to get people to support her, try to build alliance and faction over this, when I thought you could have also just said, I'm sorry. And so where did that come from, right? What I would like for her to interrogate, what made you feel that taking responsibility, having humility, thanking others for their grace when you fall short is weakness instead of strength? Because I find that the people I admire most are those who apologize from a sincere place and a virtuous place. Those who understand where they need to grow and evolve. And those are the people I want to build with. I don't want to build with people who are perfect, because I know none of us are, but I want to build with people who can take responsibility for their stuff. And I aspire to be the same. I remember I had once been dragged, and I always say, you haven't lived unless you've been dragged on Twitter at least once, right? Like, you have not. And I had been draggeth a while ago, a couple years back. And I remember thinking, this was so bad, not my smartest moment, not the smartest thing I've ever said. This is just ignorant what I said. And I thought, I'm going to leave these tweets up because there was a dialogue between the people who called me out. It was a comment about size. It was about fat phobia and size. And I had seen some people I knew who were in a plus size modeling campaign, who people I really love, and they had these really cute outfits. And I said, oh, I wish that was in my size. I want it. And I'm so sad it's not in my size because I can't have the outfit. And they said, okay, record scratch. Can you go into most retailers and find an outfit in your size? Can you go into most places, get on a plane, and not have people mock and ridicule you? Because if so, then what you just said is really not cool and it's tone deaf and problematic. And I said, you know what? I'm really sorry.
Yeah.
And so my intention was good, but my impact was bad.
Yeah.
And that was something that I needed to atone for. And I think that when I stopped sort of making it about me,
yes,
and also making it about just really thinking about, okay, you know, where did I come up with this sense of thinking in this way? What does it mean about my own internal conversation about the body and my own internal struggles with dealing with the body politic?
Yeah.
All of that. So I think that we need to normalize effing it up.
Yes.
And owning it.
Yeah, I think apologizing is wildly underrated.
I love accountability. I love accountability. It's like, it's just like, oh, and then accountability, because accountability is different than just apologizing. Because apologizing, sometimes people who are apologizing, they're also seeking something in that apology, you know? And that's the worst, because then it's like, oh, now we're making it about you again in this apology. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, but full accountability is just like, I fucked up. I'm so sorry. Thank you for still sitting in here with me, you know, that's a delightful moment between people, because you can also feel that, you know, my husband really hurt my feelings the other night. He did not mean it. He said something thoughtless, and he gave me the best apology I think he's given me in 20 years of marriage, because we've been in therapy, you know, we just know each other now. And he was like, I'm only clarifying my intent so that you understand better where I was coming from, but I know it doesn't change how I made you feel. I'm sorry that I hurt your feelings. And he owned it so much that I was able to then, I also did like understanding his intent, because I understood then better that my brain had internalized it in a weird way and, you know, whatever. But it was like a lovely apology. And he had no expectations from it. He didn't expect me to forgive him in the moment. He gave me a moment to like recover. And that's so hard to do. It's really hard to do, because I could tell he felt very ashamed of himself because he had been thoughtless. He said, I phrased that in a really thoughtless way.
I love it so much. And I think we, and also men doing this, you know, it's like cis men doing this in the world. It's so important, because there's been so much that they've been taught about, you know, never say sorry. Or I remember, you know, reading about how women candidates are discriminated against, and, you know, research about how they are perceived, and how there used to be this wisdom to be told, oh, you never want to apologize for a misstep or something like that, because then you're seen as weak, or you're somehow feminized, which is code for, you know, less of a leader. And
right.
I think that, no, the people that I really admire, the people who I feel are, you know, more mature in their experience as humans, are those who can take responsibility and say, hey, I fell short, but I'm going to do better. And I think just also being able to communicate and to listen, you know, we all have that in our marriage, right? To be married is such a great teacher, and to have that experience, to be able to say again and again, to repair and to break down and repair over and over again. And
yes, rupture and repair. That's right.
Yes, right. All of it. And I think about it all the time. I mean, my husband is white. He's Italian American. He has, you know, his own experiences that are different from my own. He's from New Hampshire, not a lot of Black people there. And we're also almost 10 years apart. And so rupture and repair happens in this relationship, and has had that for over a decade. Because there are just things that he's never experienced or seen because he has privileges that I will never know. And then there are insights about life that I think that have come to him later in life than they came to me because of my experience as a Black woman and things I had to learn as a young person that he didn't have to because society was sort of designed to protect him in ways that it isn't designed to protect Black girls. And so that has been a really interesting journey for us to be able to have these conversations, because I also know, you know, there have been some things sometimes where I'll say, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? And in the early years, a lot of it, he would just say, it's shame. This makes me feel shame when you call me out on that. And now he has language for it because he's now interrogated actually what it means to be white. And that was something that he didn't have to do until we were really together, that he, you know, had an empathy for others' experiences. He understood what white privilege was. He believed in all of those things, but he didn't have to actually think about what are the parts of being raised in this culture, but also being raised as white, you know, which is not a, you know, it's just not a scientific thing, but what our culture in America has done to being, what has that actually conditioned me into thinking? How it conditions me into how I communicate, how I expect others to communicate. He used to always say things like, ooh, the way that you tell your parents exactly what you think frightens me. I could never do that with my dad. And I said, what do you mean? And he would just say, I mean, you say what's exactly on your mind. And he said, but it's not the WASP way. And I'm like, but you're not even WASPy. Right. Like,
you're Italian American, sir.
But they, that in that environment, and he's a blonde, right? So he was also saying that, like, in that environment, in that thing, there was sort of this like aspirational way of being.
Yeah.
That came with that. Because he's technically Argentine and Italian. And they, over the years, you know, that there's, that when you look in the census, when they stop speaking Spanish, it's like in the census, and they stop speaking Italian. Like, we both found it, right? And so I think that, I think it's just an interesting, it's an interesting question that I have thought about with him a lot, that he's finding his own sense of identity, because for a long time he just said, oh, I just identified as white and I happen to have an Italian middle name because that was my grandfather's middle name, you know, or that kind of
thing. Right.
So I think I just said, oh, there was not an option for that for me, that, you know, I was not being read as anything other than Black. So that I think just us being able to have those kinds of conversations has been really helpful, but also conversations about, you know, what would it mean if we had children and how would you talk with them about who they are has really led him to be and more evolved in his own conversations with himself and with me about race.
I mean, what we're talking about is emotional courage, right? And like being emotionally courageous is, it, you feel so much lighter. And we're going back to the bravery thing, being emotionally courageous, owning your shit, listening to other people, putting that community and that in relation with others as your top priority, like at any call, like let's try to make this work together, right? And I'll be here and I'll hold space for you and I'll own my shit. There's nothing that feels better than that. It's just sitting through all of the garbage in the middle that you just have to, it's just the price, right? I mean, I don't have all the answers, but that's been my experience, you know?
I feel the same, because the emotional courage, and that's why, you know, I was saying to him that I felt like it, I feel like I can be vulnerable with him in ways that I can't with certain other white people that I've engaged with in life. And so that's also been interesting when he sees me be more guarded with certain people, the things that rankle me, you know, that he would always say, oh, it's really interesting. I see that you're not like I'm used to experiencing you around X, Y, or Z person. And I'll say it's because I'm picking up on things that you don't have to think about, or the ways in which they address me or engage me or do things, or how they maybe even tacit sort of dismissals or things that you don't have to ever engage because you're not the other. And that has been really, really interesting. But he's also given me insight into other white people's attempts to be allies that I sometimes don't see. And that has also been really interesting. I was talking about an experience I had with somebody who was a person of color, married to a white person, and I was mistaken for that person at a restaurant. and her white husband was really upset about it and seemed just really upset and was talking to me about being really upset about it. And I was saying, but that person and I were sort of laughing. We were both laughing about it because we're thinking, oh, this is just a Tuesday, right?
Like, right.
It's
right,
not going
right.
to happen, but it happened. And my husband said, no, I understand where he's coming from because I think there were probably a few things, him feeling frustrated because he's now seen how often this happens, how you have to deal with these indignities and these paper cuts every day, but then also, and like being protective of this person that you love, but also this feeling of wanting you to know that I know that it's not okay.
Yeah.
But not in a performative way, in a sincere way, and that I want to show you that I'm not just a passive bystander. So he was saying, yeah, a lot of times I am thinking about one, you, and wanting to support you, protect you, connect with you, but also giving you the space because I know you don't need a protector, but you know, but as your partner to do that, and this other part of me that feels that I want you to know that I saw it, that I know it's not okay, and that I feel really frustrated that this is how it is. And the all of the sort of complexities and the shame and weird feelings that come with that.
Yes.
So it's complicated, but I love that we're at that part now where we can have those juicy conversations.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. I have a question for you. So I'm going to change topics a little bit. So you're writing all these children's books, and I love these books, by the way. I have many of them. They're in my home. Have you experienced any banning issues with the books, or have you been worried about this, or how are you feeling about this? Because the books are so good, and you're right. It's so good to teach the kids young this kind of these things, these feelings, this openness, et cetera.
Thank you so much. So yes, I've been banned 3 times.
Fuck.
and wow. Not only for my children's books, I was once in an anthology by Amber Kaiser, and it's called The V Word, and it's a very awesome book. And it's a book that I really enjoyed being a part of. And it was called The V Word, True Stories About First Time Sex. And what I loved about the book was it was a collection of essays about what it means to have, you know, an experience of sex in your teenage years from the perspective of women, about why do we have this cultural obsession with this? But what if it came from a place of talking about agency, not losing your V card, not, what was the other thing? Not handing it in, right? Not handing in anything to anyone. But what if it means to talk about in every way and normalize all of our experiences, queer experiences, having agency, having a sense of power, what it taught you about power. What if you had a not good experience and you wanted to talk about that, and you wanted to talk about an empowering experience? So I was so proud to be a part of this collection because I thought, oh my God, imagine if I had had this book in high school when I was in Christian boarding school, at all girls school, what would it have been like when I had all these questions to be able to read a stigma smashing book like this. And that book has been banned in multiple places. There was an entire campaign to ban it and to move it from a place where young people wouldn't be able to actively see it in Charleston, South Carolina. And it's my home state. So radical feminist librarians were the MVPs of pushing back and putting themselves on the line to fight for our book. And then also Louisiana, there was a board there that was trying to use that book as an example of the kinds of books that shouldn't be in school and banning it there. And I think about that book all the time because I was so proud to be a part of a book that was about young people taking control of their lives.
Yeah.
And nuance and respecting the intelligence of the reader. And yet this very important information being withheld from the people who need it, especially in rural areas, especially in areas where they can't get this information otherwise. So I'm passionate about that. In York, Pennsylvania, there was a school that banned Young, Gifted, and Black, which was my first children's book,
Jesus.
Which is a compendium about Black history and celebrating Black life. And what I would love to share, though, about it is that the students organized. They reached out to the authors. They reached out to other people. They had a GoFundMe. They got money to get those books back into the school to overturn the ruling and to get people like myself who wrote these books to support their campaign and to amplify our voices about it. And the book is back. And there were 240 other authors, I believe, that were impacted by that ban. But they fought back. and they were successful. So I just am really passionate about this. I also want to say it's not just the United States. We're talking about that right now, but there was a white supremacist historian, is how I'd like to call him. He doesn't call himself that, but that's what he is, who has a YouTube group where he has about, at the time, it was a couple of years ago, it was about 18,000 subscribers. And I think it was 81, sorry, I'm misstating it. I flipped it in my brain. And he actually said a lot of false things about Young, Gifted, and Black, because my book, surprise, surprise, didn't reiterate his rhetoric about Nelson Mandela and Mary C. Cole, and proceeded to accuse me of not fact-checking my book and being historically inaccurate because of my anti-apartheid stance and all of those other, you know, controversial things. And a bunch of white people who didn't read it but read The Dog Whistle responded by getting into the comments, getting really intense. I saw that he was doing this with a lot of other Black authors. And there were people campaigning to try to get the book taken out of school libraries in England and discussing whether or not the kids should be able to read books like this. And it just really made me sad. But the thing that also made me angry is I received a really nasty hate mail threat as a result of him disseminating that video to his list. Hmm. What I did was I contacted YouTube. I contacted my publisher in England because I said, oh, you all have better laws about hate speech than we do. Like, how do we go down? Right. Because I just cannot stand for this. But a lot of the things, aside from the lies about the fact-checking, which I did a lot of because I had a hypervigilance of knowing this was going to happen, was this idea that there were white men using aliases in the comments saying things like, I just feel like now I can't be myself, that we are persecuted, that we can't. The fact that I have a little book talking about Black history, right, makes him feel that he is worried about himself and the world that his kids will grow up in, that my having a voice is such a threat to his fragility. And that is the part that makes me say that we must continue. I love that meme, the one that's going on Instagram now, going viral, that says, live your life as if you were a book that Florida would ban. You know, that that's like how you're living your life in the right way. And I just think that what makes me the most sad is that that is what this is really about. Ego, again, that he was actually telling some truth, saying, I'm worried that this cancels out my existence, that this idea that somehow an expansive place for everyone's voices to be heard was felt like oppression, that equality is oppression for those who actually deeply understand that we are not living in a fair landscape right now, that we are living in a landscape that is skewed toward benefiting some to the disadvantage of others. And yet he was saying, how dare you not want to continue to be on the bottom, right? How dare you want to be equal to me? So it's one of the most passionate things I'm focused on right now is to fight this and to fight challenges to free expression. I mean, I grew up in Saudi Arabia as an expat. So I know what it's like to live in a society where you have to be careful what you say and where books are censored. And I don't want that for us here.
Yeah. What can we do? What can regular people just who are not on the front lines of this do to help this? Because this is a very specific thing, this book banning. Like, I mean, there's so many issues and you can get so overwhelmed and so like helpless, hopeless. What can we do with the book ban situation? Because it really seems messed up to me. Like, you know, is there anything that you think that you would advise people who are outraged by this to do?
Oh my gosh, yes. So speak up. Speak up, keep speaking up. That is so important. We hear about these stories of these people who go in and are just not even reading books that they're writing down to get banned in libraries from kids. And we don't hear enough about what those of us who disagree are doing to talk about how much Drag Queen Story Hour excited and engaged our students. So I worked a lot with Drag Queen Story Hour when I was at Feminist Press. Kids love Drag Queen Story Hour. And I will shout from the rooftops how important I think it is that kids go to those events, to library events, and they experience joy and they meet other kids and they color and they get to experience what it means to be creative and to accept others, no matter how they're expressing themselves. And I feel that with that same energy of, you know, okay, we are upset about the banning, we should also uphold and support the things that are working right, to say, oh, I actually want to see more drag queen story in my community. Right. I want to see more diverse authors in this library. If you have the bandwidth, run for school board. We need more of us in these school boards and in these PTAs shaping the conversation. Donate books to your library. Donate money to your local library. Donate to communities in need. Donate to books to shelters. To the kids who need these books are the ones, sadly, who I'm most worried about, because they need these books as lifelines and are being cut away from getting them in a lot of these rural communities or communities with access deserts. The House of Speakeasy does amazing work. If you have money to donate, donate to them, because they get books to book deserts all across the country in amazing ways. Also, PEN America. Donate to PEN. And fight for people who are bravely writing, and like you said, in the emotional courage, who are being brave. And I think all of those pieces are so important. And if you also just, if you are a person who has space in your community where you can host a book talk, where you can host gatherings around books or book clubs for books that are banned, those are really helpful. If you can commission books for curriculum around something, you can invite speakers, do it, especially those people whose books are being hit by these bans. My church does a multicultural book fair every year. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing. And many of us are banned people who participate in that. And I go to an amazing progressive church. But I would just say, we all have a way that we can contribute, and think about what is the way that you can step into your power and do it in a very local way that will have reverberations.
This has been so great.
This is, we could talk to you for hours. This has been so great. We have to have you back on. You're amazing. I love talking to you. I always love talking to you.
Me too. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I just was so honored when you asked me. I'm a big fan of your work too. And this has brought me a lot of joy today to be able to talk with you both. And I love the questions as well. And it means a lot to me that you're talking about the book banning, because I don't know if people who haven't lived in a society where information is controlled yet really understand the heft of what this means and what could potentially be even worse if we don't address this now. So it just really means a lot to me that you are speaking boldly and being brave and inspiring others to do so.
Jamia, where can people find you? I want them to find you.
Thank you so much. So you can find me on my website, jamiawilson.org, and that has access to my socials and also to my books and speaking engagements. Those are happening again, which is really exciting. So I would love to connect. Insta is where I usually am on social media. As an emerging auntie, as I like to say, I'm lurking on TikTok. So I think I have a total of 2 TikToks.
Same.
That are up.
Same.
Right? I was going to say, like, do I have a TikTok presence? I have 2 TikToks.
I have one. I have one. Yes.
That's how I knew. I thought, oh, I'm definitely in my 40s because I'm TikToks. But although I would say there are a lot of people our age who have more TikToks, but
they figured it out.
We have figured it out. I'm like, this is how I had the moment thinking, oh, this must have been like what my mom was going through with Facebook at some point.
Totally. Nothing makes me feel older than being on TikTok, to be honest. Same. I'm just like, exactly. Thank you so much, Jamia.
Yeah, thanks, Jamia.
Thanks for listening to Everything is Fine. We're your hosts. I'm Jen Romolini.
And I'm Kim France.
If you like the show, like I say every week, please rate, review it on all the platforms, and subscribe if you haven't subscribed. If you want to support the production of the show and help us keep the lights on, you can join our Patreon at patreon.com/everythingisfine. We do bonus episodes there, live events. We blog there sometimes. If you want to follow us on social media, we're at EIF Podcast on Instagram. We're on Facebook with a robust and private Facebook group. We're on Twitter. We're on LinkedIn. We should not be on either. Please join Kim's Substack at kimfrance.substack.com. You can find me on Jennifer Rupta. Who cares? I'm never there anyway. It doesn't matter. The show is mixed and edited by my favorite, Natalie Rivera. I love you, Natalie.
Yay, Natalie.
And we'll be back next week.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.